Hi, hello. We have a fun episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, Cade Cunningham is coming off of yet another tremendous game against the New York Knicks. The Pistons are the best team in the league right now. Is Cade Cunningham your MVP? Is he the best player in the league right now? We talk about that and a little bit more. And then we get into the mailbag. We got a lot of awesome questions. We got tanking proposals. We got questions about our favorite jump shots in the league, what it means to be the face of the league at this point, excitement level about the Kings in the second half of the year, what lineups we want to see. We bounce around the league. We bounce around the W as well. Can the Wings make a major jump in the standings behind Paige Becker's awesome play? And then we preview the unrivaled weekend. We have a lot of marquee matchups. Angel Reese is back. We have some potential shifting in the standings playoff-wise. All of that and more. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday. How are we doing?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Ready to talk some hoops.
We are going to talk plenty of hoops, and we are getting into some hoops talk in the Dunker Spot mailbag. So a quick thank you to everyone who sent in questions. And as usual, if you ever have basketball thoughts or any general thoughts, you can always email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. We will get to them. We have a mailbag episode planned for you today. This was just going to be a full-blown mailbag episode and flowing into Unrivaled to cap things off. But then Cade Cunningham was incredibly rude to the New York Knicks once again, as it's a 3-0 record in the Cade games against New York so far this year. He has been absurd in pretty much all of them. And last night, he drops 42 points, 12 of 23 inside the arc, 5-11 from three, only three free throw attempts, all of them made in this game, 8 boards, 13 assists, as the Pistons once again took care of business, once again established themselves as the best team in the Eastern Conference. And as we mentioned on the last pod, in terms of the winning percentage, they have the best record in the NBA. Steve. And we, funny enough, we got a mailbag question about Cade, so it felt appropriate to start off with this one from one of our longtime dunkers. Matt says, hi, Steve and Nikias, big fan, been listening since 2014. I have two questions. Is Cade Cunningham the best player in the league? And considering the answer to the first question is yes, how wide is the gap? Now, while I appreciate the question, it's a very good bit. I can't personally get to Cade Cunningham is the best player in the league. I will say, I don't want to do the thing like Cade hasn't gotten attention, because he has. The Pistons have gotten attention. Like, I think there's still room to talk more about what the Pistons have done and what Cade in particular is doing, hence us starting the show with Cade Cunningham. It did make me think a little bit deeper about what his MVP case is. He's also coming off of, I think, the GQ interview, where he was very clear about, hey, I feel like I'm the best American player in the league. Like, I feel like I'm one of the best players in the league, period. There are some guys that y'all think are better than me that aren't. Got some bars within that article. I guess on a general note, Steve, like, how have you absorbed this Cade Cunningham season? And like, where does he rank for you in terms of the top players in the league right now?
Well, I mean, Cade Cunningham has been very, very good this entire season. He's been very big reason why the Detroit Pistons are where they are. And I think you have to look at his offensive growth. I think it's easy to look at certain numbers and maybe be like, oh, efficiency, but I don't think that tells the whole story. Detroit isn't where they are without Cade Cunningham being a consistent engine for them offensively. And the type of shots that he can create on his own, the way he can operate within space, and the growth that he's had playmaking-wise, as far as being able to see how defenses are treating him, to make the right reads, to make the right plays. Well, defenses of Thunderdome haven't phased him. You know, we've seen teams try and double. We've seen teams try and switch. We've seen teams try and put length and size on him. You know, he's been able to get downhill and kind of control the game in his own way. He can get to his step back when he wants to. He's not afraid to put his head down and get to the paint and drive and finish. And that's just been a blend for teams that have been hard. It's been hard to deal with. And so if you look at a Detroit team where it's like, oh, they can't shoot, they can't do this, who stopped Cade Cunningham? And I think sometimes you forget like the role of a lead scorer sometimes means I have to still find a way to get the ball in the basket. And sometimes that takes 34 shots to get 42 points. You know, everyone's going to say, oh, well, that's inefficient. I don't respect that. That takes a lot of confidence to continue to keep pressure on a team, to continue to try and find your shots. Not a lot of people can continue to get those kind of field goal attempts up. So I think for me, it's hard to not have Cade as a top five player this year?
I think on a baseline level, Steve, I'm with you. He has just been incredibly good this season. And I think there's a bit of vindication to be had for the quote unquote Cade fans and specifically the Pistons fans over the last year and a half, where you watch Cade Cunningham when the Pistons were not as good. You see the context that Cade was operating in. I've said on this very podcast multiple times, hey, Cade's kind of operating in a phone booth right now. Like, there are some growth areas for him, like the low free throw rate, the relatively low free throw rate, you know, for his skill set early on in his career. Like, there was some foul drawing craft that he had to get better at, but the floor was also cramped. There are also some elements of he's not getting some of these calls that you would think that he would get. And Cade alluded to that in that interview as well. But he has gotten better. The context has gotten a little bit better. And ultimately, the Pistons were a playoff team last year. They were very good. And they have been the best team in the Eastern Conference. And in terms of win percentage, they have been the best team in the league this year. And so, like, just on a basic level, I'm just happy for Cade that he's having this. He's been able to kind of push through with Detroit. They have built a better team around him. And now they are playing at this level. And so, 2K specifically, it hasn't just been all-star level for him. It hasn't just been all NBA level for him. This has been MVP level stuff for Cade Cunningham. And that's before getting into the games played minimum, where we don't know if Jokic is ultimately going to end up qualifying. We don't know if Wimby is ultimately going to end up qualifying. We don't know if Luka is going to end up qualifying. Giannis is already out and the Bucks are down in the standings anyway. Like, before you even get into some of those cases, and we're keeping an eye on Shea out for at least another week with the abdominal strain. If he does come back next week, say next Friday against Denver, that means he's missing four games in that span. That will put him at 49 games played out of 60 heading into the matchup with Denver. So that's still about 82% of games. So he's still safe on that regard. But if he suffers another one, or if they're more conservative with that, you got to keep an eye on the Shea eligibility. So that opens up the pathway for Cade MVP even more with players dropping. But he has just played that well. The scoring has been there. It's been funny kind of tracking the three-point shooting, where he's knocking down 37% of his pull-ups, but the catch-and-shoot numbers have been kind of low. You're just kind of waiting on that to normalize. But even with the pull-up three in particular, like, he's taking more of those than the catch-and-shoot opportunities. That speaks to what his role is, but it also speaks to the level of comfort that he has grown with that shot. It's why you've seen teams be more willing to put length on him or lean more into switching or put more two on the ball against Cade this year, because giving him drop means he can lead the dance, play at his own pace, get to the mid-range and knock down shots, get to the rim with more foul drawing craft and get to the line, open up some of those lobs to Jalen Duren or Paul Reed or whoever the big he's playing with. And now, on top of this, I can just flow into pull-up threes. Like, he just has the complete scoring package at this point, in addition to, again, the playmaking reads that he can make. And something that J.B. Bickerstaff has been talking about pretty much all year long, this Detroit defense is elite. He's been pretty intentional about noting, hey, Cade is a part of this too. Like, I don't think he is Detroit's best defender, to be clear. Like, I think that is Asar Thompson. They have dogs up and down that lineup and in that rotation. But Cade's been kind of wild as a secondary rim protector. Like, he can play the passing lanes and generate turnovers in that way. So, like, there is a two-way element to what he's been able to do as well. I've been super impressed with his game. I think he very much deserves to be in the MVP conversation, which we were talking about this a little bit pre-pod, Steve, where I've just kind of been in a loop thinking about, like, what are my Cade versus Shea arguments? What are my Cade versus Jaylen Brown arguments? You know, especially, again, with Jokic kind of up in the air, Wimby kind of up in the air, things like that. Like, I think still, as of today, Shea would be my MVP. But the Cade case, on balance, is a pretty darn strong one. Like, it's 26 points, 6 rebounds, 10 assists, a steal and a half, and nearly a block. Those box score numbers are incredibly strong. As you kind of alluded to with the efficiency, if you are dinging him for literally anything this year compared to some of the other top-end MVP candidates, it is going to be the efficiency. About a 57 true shooting, that's about a point below what league average is right now, around 58. But you factor in what the context is, the defensive coverages that he's seeing, the amount of help that he's seeing on drives, which to that end, Steve, first, second spectrum, seeing help on about 84% of his drives, that is third highest among 91 players to log at least 300 drives. Only Trey Murphy III and Shaedon Sharpe are higher than that. Like, it makes sense why the efficiency numbers may be a little bit lower than you would anticipate. But he still has Detroit here. He's still doing a little bit of everything on both ends of the floor. Like, he has just been incredible this season. And the flashbulb moments for him, we're coming off of a Knicks performance where he just had 40. He's continued to build these moments. And so, like, there are a lot of things pointing to, hey, Cade deserves to be even more in the conversation than we're giving him credit for.
Yep.
Just a firm. I respect it. No, I've just, this KC season has been really fun. I think even to the underlying stuff, Pistons about 11 points per, nearly plus 11 per 100 possessions with Cade on the floor. Like, that is MVP level stuff for him. You look at some of the play type data for him, is over 1.2 points per possession on post-ups, is over 1.1 points per possession on ISOs, nearly 1.1 points per possession on drives, and that's with seeing the amount of help that he's seeing on these drives. Again, thriving within this kind of context is insane. So, I can't get to best player in the league, but legitimate MVP candidate should be on your all-NBA first team pretty firmly. And if we get any kind of like games minutes gap between him and Shea, or if Shea becomes ineligible, like, I think the door is wide open for a Cade MVP. Like, I wouldn't sneeze at that at this rate. He's been incredible. So wanted to start there with that. Steve, I would like to apologize in advance. We do have a little bit more tanking commentary. As Sean Gerani of ESPN.
Why? I can't believe y'all did this for an entire week. Why are we doing this? What is this? No more mailbags. If there's no more mailbags, there's a tank question. What is this?
No more. Put my foot down. Well, Steve is putting his foot down. Unfortunately, I think this is more so triggered by the reporting that we got from ESPN, Shyam Charania, that Adam Silver informed all 30 GMs that anti-tanking rule changes are coming as soon as next year. Among the ideas that have been discussed, per Shyam's report, first round picks can only be protected top four or top 14 plus. I would imagine the plus means, like, if there is any kind of changing to who's invited into the draft lottery that extends the play-in teams, then you'd be looking at like 16 or 18 instead of the 14. Either way, you're looking at top four protections or just lottery protections. That's something that's been discussed. Would you like that shift if they make that one?
No.
Okay. Next one, lottery odds being frozen at the trade deadline or a later date, to try to curb some of the late season, we're not playing these guys, et cetera.
Yeah, a mystery date where the season ends. That's a brilliant idea. Won't definitely cannibalize the start of the year. Two thumbs up on that one.
Okay, let's see how Steve feels about that one. All right. No longer allowing a team to pick top four in consecutive years and or after consecutive bottom three finishes. Okay. Fair enough. Teams can't pick top four the year after making the conference finals. Like, that very much feels like a Dallas Mavericks / Indiana Pacers bit, which I understand the spirit of that change if it happens. It is just kind of funny that the two examples that we've seen recently is like the Mavericks come off the finals, they trade Luka Doncic and then jump in the lottery to get Cooper Flagg. Like, I don't know if you can really predict that kind of thing. And with the Indiana Pacers, their best player tore his Achilles, and they've dealt with an ungodly amount of injuries. Like, the great Caitlin Cooper has been talking about this pretty much all year long. Also just had like a great thread about this yesterday, where it's like, why are we punishing a situation like the Pacers, where like they haven't tried to lose? They lost Tyrese. They lose Miles Turner free agency. We had a portion of the season very early on where literally their entire guard rotation was out at the same time. Like, they shouldn't be punished for that. But I also understand the logic of, well, we can't have the 1 year dip to where a team that was just in the finals adds a top three prospect potentially. And that top, which means that top three prospect isn't going to a legitimate bad team. Like, I get it. I don't like that. I understand the logic, but I don't like that one. Lottery odds allocated based on 2 year records. Like, that feels very WNBA coded. That's a similar system that they have there. Like, I would hear that one out at the very least. Lottery extended to include all play-in teams, which again gets into that top 14 plus in terms of the pick protections, if that is a thing that happens, and flattening the odds for all lottery teams. I get it. I think part of the reason why we're having this level of tanking, you know, aside from like this draft class projects to be incredibly good, is because the odds are flattened. And I think this is two or three straight years where the team with the worst record in the league has just kind of slid to fourth or fifth in the lottery because the team's jumping, with the lottery odds already kind of being flattened at the top. Like, if you flatten that even more, that gets kind of hazy. Again, I understand the logic of doing that, but I don't know if I love that one either. Like, does literally anything on this list intrigue you at all for potential, maybe not a fix, but these things up? Okay. It fair doesn't. Enough. So we will see.
Some teams are just bad.
Yeah.
And then you try and be good again. Like, we were looking at a season where Detroit has turned things around. You remember where they were at. San Antonio turned things around. They had lottery luck. And he's not supposed to be here. We've done this before. I can't believe we're still here in 2026. That's all I'm going
to say. No, I think that's fair. Like, I think there's only so much you can do from a rule perspective in general. Because I think, to your point, there are teams that are just bad. And I think as long as the landscape is what it is, with the aprons, with what free agency has turned into because of how all these suspensions are happening, like, I think you are just kind of running out of avenues to quickly turn your team around outside of landing a prospect that takes you there. And so as long as that remains not just your best, but becoming one of your only options to flip, teams in those situations, teams that are bad or teams that are in the middle that need to get bad, they're going to try to find ways to get into the lottery. So, like, I understand why the league is saying, well, it can't be what it is right now, where we're coming off of two teams being fined and some of the late game hijinks and stuff like that. I understand from the league perspective. Teams just want to, like, nobody wants to be at the bottom for four straight years or five straight years. Like, the Kings did not want to be what the Kings were. You know what I mean? So, like, I don't know how much you can actually do. Like, I'm intrigued by, like, the pick protection bit at the very least. But aside from that, like, I don't know if you can rule change your way out of this when this is kind of the team building reality that we're in right now. So we will see. But related to that, we have gotten two mailbag questions about potential fixes. Wanted to get to those before we get into the other round of fun questions. This one coming from Judge, who says, "Hey, fellas, thank you as always for your time, Kais and Steve, and for the best and most informative hoop show there is. Thank you. I've got an idea to fix tanking and wanted to hear your guys' thoughts on it for the next mailbag. To fix tanking in the league, what if they had a tournament at the end of the season for all of the lottery teams to compete for the number one pick? I think you could fix tanking and schedule fatigue, help playoff minutes, and incentivize winning all in one fell swoop with a lottery tournament. Some of the reasons listed. The in-season tournament has been fun and competitive, but by the end of the year, it seems like nobody really remembers who won it. And this year, especially, players and coaches have complained about the schedule crunch. Instead of the in-season tournament, let the eight playoff teams rest for 2 weeks at the end of the season and cut maybe 6 to 8 games out of the official schedule to give them a reward and hopefully help with injuries that decide way too much of the playoffs. Then have a lottery tournament where the best lotto team is the top seed, the worst is the bottom, etc. Give all the lotto teams and their fans some huge national TV games with major stakes on the line to cheer for, and give all the players the chance to become beloved tournament legends. Imagine if someone like Devin Carter hit a game winner to get AJ DeBonta on the Kings. He's good for life in Sacramento. And it incentivizes every team to win as many games as possible and to be good to have a chance in the tournament. Of course, you still have the borderline playoff teams want to tank to be the one seed in the lotto tournament instead of the 8 seed in the playoffs, but A, they're already doing that anyway, and B, you could limit the tank fest at the end of the year from 15-plus teams, hopefully down to 3 or 4. And, of course, you could provide more substantial bonuses for the 8 playoff teams, maybe in the form of cap relief or cash bonuses. Anyway, I think this is a radical idea, but it could be great, and would love to hear your guys' thoughts on it. Thank you for your time." So I think for me, a lot of people kind of floated out, what if we had some sort of tournament to kind of earn your way to the top pick? So, like, I'm not mad at that as a concept. I think the Kings example had me in a loop for like 10 minutes, if I would have peeled the curtain back a little bit. Because on one hand, my initial thought was like, what incentive would, you know, obviously I don't think any players are going to like tank the tournament or anything like that. But if you're just talking about extra incentive to really make the tournament what it could be from an entertainment standpoint and from a competitive standpoint, if I'm DeMar DeRozan, it's just like, well, what am I doing? Like, what does this mean for me exactly? Like, the Devin Carter point, I don't think it's incorrect, because I think every fan base has like their cult heroes that have done something or had a stretch of play or whatever that has made them beloved for years beyond like what they've actually did with their team. So I wouldn't be surprised if something like that would actually pop off. But even then, it's like, what does that mean? But then I was like, hey, we're not super far removed from Domantas Sabonis having that meeting with the Kings. Like, hey, what exactly is our direction here? What are we trying to get on? Does this set up a situation with the Kings in particular to where the vets might have been like, hey, what if we play well enough? They get this pick. This kind of streamlines their rebuild. This gets me to a better situation quicker. Like, Sabonis is out for the year. LaVine is out for the year. So it wouldn't impact things directly this season if this thing existed. But in general, like, I'm in a bad situation. if this team actually wins the lottery, they may be more willing to kind of go backwards. I can get to a win now situation. Does that give me some incentive in a counterintuitive way? Like for Devin Carter, like I hit this game winning shot. We win the number one pick. They draft Darren Peterson. And now my minutes are even more in peril. Like, I don't know how he would feel about that after the fact. Yes, like raising the his overall value elsewhere. But like, I don't know. I don't know. Like, I think this ultimately ends up being a no for me. Like, I don't, like, I think removing games from the schedule, the league is probably like, well, we're not giving up that revenue if we can help it. I think the rest incentive is a positive one. But removing games from the schedule, like, that gets kind of wonky. Like, how does that impact, like, the games played thing? There are more questions than answers for me, so I ultimately say no on that front. But I do like the spirit of what you're getting at. Steve, do you have any thoughts on the Judge proposal?
What is the buy-in level to get these players to play in this tournament? What's the coach speech to get these players to play in this tournament? Why are we taking the focus off the playoffs in the last 2 weeks of the season when we have this Western Conference that has all these teams chasing each other and trying to jockey for position, and we're going to give that tournament to the last eight teams? The play-in's fine. Play-in works. We can talk about that. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that kind of level of play. Didn't we just have the two lottery teams played yesterday? Did anyone talk about that? Are we still talking about tanking? What are we doing? What's tournament going to do? Who's going to play in this tournament? What's the motivation? How am I getting my guys riled up for this one? What happens if you lose in the first round? You did all that for what? Not for me.
Yeah. Understood. I do wonder like what the cash bonuses will look like for the playoff teams. Like, what is that figure? And even for the teams in the tournament, like, team-wide, I win the number one pick. Like, that's obviously incentive. But for the players themselves, it's like, okay, what exactly am I getting with this? Are they also getting a cash prize for this? Is this, what, $250K? Like, I don't know. Like, I guess I would just send a follow-up email, give me some more details on that kind of thing.
So the playoff teams are getting more money? They already get money for making the playoffs.
That is true. But I guess for there, like, if you are, again, if you're losing six or eight games of, like, gate, like, the rest is impactful, but I guess that is still literal money on the table. If not for the players, at least team-wide.
Hey, good luck with that. So.
There you go. Okay. The second one we got, this is coming from Zach, says, hello, Nikias and Steve. I love the podcast. It's helped me understand the NBA better and has also gotten me more into the WNBA. I wonder what you think of this method of dealing with tanking, as I haven't heard this specific idea floated before. The five lowest records automatically get the top five picks, but the order in which they get those picks is reversed, i.e. the fifth worst record gets the top pick, the fourth worst record gets the second pick, and so on, with the worst record getting the fifth pick. I think this would allow bad teams to improve, but also not incentivize them to be too bad. There would still probably be tanking to get into the bottom five, but the worst teams would be incentivized to try hard in order to get a better pick. Obviously, this would still have issues with the fifth, sixth, seventh, fourth teams trying to do some buffoonery towards the end of the season as they attempt to get the fifth, fourth spot. But I think the pros outweigh the cons here. What do you all think?
I don't like that you would have an automatic. That's a dangerous thing to pull. Because why would I not try and make sure I have this exact record? If I have this exact record, I have the top pick, so I'm good to go. No thanks. Let these teams just be bad, man. I'm so unmoved by all this conversation, man.
I feel you. I guess I'll quickly say, we got this, and my immediate thought was like, okay, so what happens with the other teams outside of this? The top five is locked. Are the rest of the non-playoff teams then in a lottery to decide, like, 6 through 14? Is that going just regular record at that point? Like, I would just want more clarification on that part of the program, first and foremost. And then, as you alluded to in the email, like, I think, hey, if we have the seventh worst record in the league, can we get to fifth? It may not be a full-blown plummet to the bottom, to your point, so you're curbing at least some of that, but there is still, we have a target to hit. And to your point, Steve, if it is a guaranteed number one versus we have the top odds, it could get kind of funny towards the end of the year in a different way. So I think you're kind of moving the target there. And again, like, I want kind of wonder, like, how does the rest of the lottery and thus the rest of the first round kind of play out with that kind of thing? And I guess even beyond that, I would kind of wonder, like, what happens to pick protections in that situation? like that's just another, I guess that's another layer to this. Like obviously you'd be kind of implementing this heading into next season, but like what do you do with that kind of thing? Does that change like what the protections allowed would be? Does it go from top five instead of top four in that regard? And again, with the lottery, like, is that now a lottery or is that just kind of straight line? Like, what is that? What does that do? So, like, I would want to hear a little bit more on that front. But I get the heart of the idea, though. Like, I think that is an interesting one. I just want a little bit more clarity on some of those things to kind of think that through a little bit more. But with that, we're going to save Steve. We're going to save our dear viewers. We're going to take a break. And when we return, we have some more fun mailbag questions coming your way. Welcome back to this episode of The Dunker Spot. Let's get back to the mailbag. This one coming from Blue Sky. Hi, Dunker Spot. Your close personal Blue Sky friend, Snacks on Snacks here. Your answers last time were wonderful. I'd love to hear your thoughts on a few more questions. Number one, as a Minnesotan, I've been spoiled watching legendary defenders. Kevin Garnett, Rudy Gobert, Nafisa Collier, Sylvia Fowles. But I've struggled to see Alanna Smith's impact on D. What can I look for to better appreciate her game?
Oh, I mean, I think there's a loudness to her game with the ability to block shots, but I think it's overall impact for Alanna Smith and her ability to rotate and be consistent as far as protecting the rim. And I think sometimes that gets overlooked because there is sort of a loudness that can come with defense that people can see sometimes. But if you're talking about someone whose nails rotating all the time and a big pillar and key for the Lynx defensive run over the last couple of years, it's been Alanna Smith. And so being able to defend multiple positions, being able to have great timing, be able to protect the paint, slide, make the extra rotations, protect the paint, she's done that time and time again. And so I think that's one of those things where you just kind of take a look and watch her on a defensive possession, watch her rotations, watch her effort, watch her communications, and you'll kind of see and understand a little bit more, okay, this is why she's so important to this defense. It's not always going to come blocks and steals, although she's up there in stocks every single year. It's just kind of taking a second to understand, okay, if she doesn't nail this rotation, the Lynx are in trouble. They can't be as active. If she's not able to kind of compete with different positions or get into a late switch against a guard and contain that penetration, how good is that Lynx defense? I think it's more so understanding how important she is to the base of that defense than just purely being like, well, she's a one-on-one stopper type defender. Because while she's going to compete, it's more of the overall consistency and the contribution to the base that Alanna Smith provides every night.
Yeah, I think just to bounce off of that, Steve, because you nailed most of the major notes I was going to hit on. Like her being able to take on centers just in general unlocks so much for Minnesota's defense. This is where you get to fully unlock Nafisa Collier as someone that can blow up things with switches or just unlock her as a roamer in general, because Alanna Smith is battling with those bigs. And it was kind of an up and down experience for her during the 2024 season. Last year, she was so much better defending post-ups in general, just kind of pushing out catches, some of the fronts that she can get into, making those passes more difficult. And again, if you have Nafisa Collier roaming on the back end, good luck trying to get those passes in. If it's, you know, it's going to get picked off, or if it's made, it's an immediate double team. Minnesota really good at rotating out of that, forcing turnovers. And to Steve's point, her ability to execute multiple coverages in and of herself can get up to the level if necessary, can switch, especially getting to some of those late switches. Those are there. Her calling out as many scram switches as she does to get Courtney Williams or some of those other guards out of trouble. Like those are kind of the quieter things that make that defense run as smoothly as it does. Her communication, to Steve's point, has been incredibly important. And I think just in general, like watch her footwork and watch the hand activity. Like that also plays into the stocks and getting the blocks and some of the stuff at the rim. Like the rotation instincts are certainly there. But when she's at the level of screens or when she's getting ready to switch, just kind of watch how she stabs at the ball handler. Let me disrupt your rhythm before you try to set up this attack. And again, Minnesota behind her can kind of fill gaps. We can poke at things. We can shrink the floor behind that and things like that. And Alanna Smith, I think, has done a good job of holding up her end of the bargain in general in space. But yeah, it's just a little bit of everything. I think she was a very deserving like co-defense player of the year this year. I think she ultimately was my number one pick. I didn't have an official ballot, but she was one for me. I think in general, there's just more appreciation that can be had for what Alanna Smith does on defense. So I really appreciate that question. To the second one, what are ways defenses try to get Denny Avdija or other one-hand dominant players off of his right hand or his dominant hand? What kind of counters does Portland deploy to get him free to drive right? This was force another
them,
one that kind
force
of
them, force them left.
That's just it.
But I guarantee you that guys, you enjoyed this question. So what do you got, buddy?
Oh, man. I think for me, well, to Steve's point, like, hey, if this player wants to get to the left all the time, wants to get to the right all the time, we're going to try to shade you to the opposite hand. Like, I think this is where you've seen, looking at some of the coverage stats for Denny, like, teams are icing him more than they did last year. I think it was 90 reps of ice coverage that he saw last season. He's already at 101, and we're just hitting the post all-star break number. And even the rate of those has gotten higher. So, like, that's going to be a basic way of, if he's in pick and roll, let's try to get him away from that hand. Let's see if we can shade him the other way, force him to do something else. As far as potential counters, like, a lot of this, honestly, as I was telling Steve ahead of the pod, I just watched an ungodly amount of Denny Avdia drives. I did not watch all 902 that he's logged so far this year. I'm not going to give you the actual number. Just know it's a lot. A lot of this is just, I'm getting to my right hand, even when you try to shade me to my left. Like, looking at some of the closeout attacks for him, where they are very intentionally closing out to a certain side to make sure he can only go to his left. It is just, let me jab this way and then attack your top foot and get to my right hand anyway. Like, they do sprinkle in some of when they use Donovan Clingan as a hub above the breaker on the wing. Like, you'll have Denny kind of roping around those, getting a catch on the move. Or when some of the other players are driving, I think Denny is quietly not a great shooter, but he is someone that is intentional about, I am relocating, I'm respacing, I'm catching the ball on the move, which makes it a little bit easier for him to get to that right-hand attack off of those kind of situations. So you have that kind of stuff. Like, you look at some of the off-ball stuff that he gets, like, you'll see him, like, I'm stationed in the left corner, so I'm getting to my right anyway. Like, you see some of that. You'll see some of the pick and roll rejects for him. But, like, I don't feel like it's been a major, we are scheming all of this to make sure he gets to his right. Like, a lot of this is just Denny being determined to get to the right hand no matter what the game plan is. And like, you listed some of the post-game pressers for teams facing Portland on good Denny nights. It's like, well, the game plan was this. He just got there anyway. There are some aspects of we did not execute our game plan, but Denny has really forced the issue. And I think when teams being super locked in on let's force into this way, that alters what your body positioning is. And because Denny has gotten so good at reading body positioning and generating contact and getting to the free throw line, you're kind of in a catch 22. You want to take away the dominant hand, but in order to do that, you're positioning yourself in a way that opens up more foul drawing opportunities for him. And you don't want to end up in the bonus or have your best defenders in foul trouble. It's just kind of tough to deal with. And just quickly on the numbers front, again, 902 drives logged as of recording. That is a little over is 1.06 points per possession on any trip featuring a drive. Solid number there. 607 of his 902 drives have gone right. And the efficiency on those naturally goes up, 1.13 points per possession on those trips. 607 right-hand drives for Denny leads the NBA. Donovan Mitchell is second with 447. It is a gap of 160 drives to the point of him being that kind of hand, right-hand dominant. But teams haven't done a good enough job of taking that away. So that is where you go there. All right, next question is going to come from Eric, who says, or who asked, can Paige Bueckers and the Dallas Wings contend for a WNBA title this season? She looks amazing and unrivaled, and they have the number one pick. Can she recruit two or three high-level starters to join her and make a title run in her second season?
For me, one, I don't know if they're going to contend for a title this season. I think the Dallas Wings will make a leap. One, because who knows who's going to be where and when they will be available to be there. But I do think this could be a situation where you're able to add more pieces to the team and take another leap, maybe accelerate the rebuild to a degree. So I don't know if they're going to contend this season because this is still a very competitive league. It's going to be a little more spread out. It's not going to be as easy, and teams are going to have to come together very quickly. So there could be an advantage of some teams stay together to kind of elevate. But you could put yourself in a position to make some noise depending on who you add and what you add. And Paige has been really good and unrivaled. I think, you know, having an understanding of what is expected of her, having an understanding of how defenses are looking to guard her, and being able to kind of have a year where she got stronger and better, it's only going to serve her. So I would not be surprised if Dallas makes a leap. I don't know if it's going to be that we're a contender for the title type beat because it's hard to win the W.
Incredibly difficult indeed. I guess first and foremost, like, can we please get a CBA done so we can actually have a next season? I'm glad some progress is being made, but let's close this gap. Let's get this thing done. On top of that, though, I'm with you, Steve. Like, I think contend for a title is going to be too steep for me. I think that's less about Paige and more about Dallas would really have to reconfigure this roster. Like, I think it's helpful that pretty much, what, 90%+ of the league is an unrestricted free agent this year. And so when we do get a CBA done, you would have, like I said, at this point, like an abbreviated free agency period. But like, you do have the opportunity. Hey, Paige, what are the recruiting skills like? In addition to, as mentioned in the question, we have the number one pick, whether that's Alua Fam, do you go AZ Fudd? Do you go Lauren Betts, get more size up front? Like, you have options there, or worst case scenario, or not even worst case scenario, if you want to go the other way, hey, can we use this pick to get insert player or players here? If there are some other rookie scale players around the league that intrigue you around Paige Beckers, can we use this pick to get two of those or something like that? But yeah, it's going to be kind of steep for me, because like, even looking at what free agency is going to be, I would imagine like the Aces core is going to be back. I would imagine the Liberty's core is going to be back. I would imagine the Mercury's core is going to be back. And then if you have any other like all-star movement going to any of those other three teams, you know, can add Atlanta to the mix where they had multiple all-stars. Like, if another star says, actually, I'm going to one of those four, that makes it even more difficult for Dallas to contend with those teams, in addition to adding more talent into the room for them. So I think next year is a little bit too steep. I do think it's a testament to how good Paige was in her rookie season, how good she has been, an unrivaled, to your point, obviously a different context, but 24.5 points for her, that is third in unrivaled, 6.3 assists, that is second. She'll obviously rack up stocks defensively. So like, I think she is ready to give, I'd say she's ready to give like top 10 value or top 8 or top 7 value in the league next season. Like, that wouldn't surprise me. Or an all W first team, you know, run next season wouldn't surprise me. That she has to get there, but her talent level is that high. I think building around her is going to take a little bit more time. So can't get the contention yet, but I do think Dallas is going to be in a better spot next season. So I appreciate that question, Eric. Now, next couple are going to come from Xander, who says, gents, hi and hello. After watching Hoops over the All-Star weekend, it got me thinking about bucket getters and shooters. So I have a couple of questions for you both. Number one, who would you pick as a one-on-one shot maker? Kawhi Leonard or Chelsea Gray?
This is a very tough one for me, because when Kawhi does what Kawhi does, it's very tough to stop. That Chelsea Gray playoff run is still burned in my brain, and what Chelsea Gray did to the Storm and the entire league by making every single shot known to man, woman, and everyone else in between. So I'm going to go with Chelsea Gray, because talk about get to your spot, get it up, and it just does not matter what your contest is. There's really not much you can do with it. Now, Kawhi, it's going to be like a step back, a fade. You know how that shot's going to look. Chelsea, it's just there's an arc to it. There's a I'm hitting you and it goes up. There's a fadeaway. Like, I don't know. It's Chelsea Gray for me still.
Yeah. Like, I think this is, to your point, is a tough question. I think it's a fun question overall. And it's especially a fun question to ask right now with Kawhi Leonard in the midst of what is arguably the best scoring stretch of his career. And I think what makes this closer now with Kawhi in particular is that Kawhi has become a lot more willing to not only take threes, but take threes off the bounce. Because my initial thought was I'd probably go Chelsea, because you have the mid-range scoring and she will also bomb you away with pull-up threes or step-back threes on top of this. The fact that Kawhi is now also doing this with volume and efficiency is like, ooh, what do you do with this? I probably also lean Chelsea, but it's a lot closer now with Kawhi taking threes to this degree. Like, there is just obviously, you know, comparable size, doing like the size comparisons compared to their own leagues. Like, I think Kawhi does have like the higher release point, things like that. And like, kind of wonder like the rim pressure in general, he has the edge there. The mid-range and the three-point shot making, I would probably still lean Chelsea for just talking about like the peak versions of themselves in general. So I lean Chelsea. And just quickly to your point, Steve, the 22 playoff run is what you were talking about with Chelsea Gray. 21.7 points per game, 65.5% on twos, 54.4% from three on 5.7 attempts during that run. It was legitimately one of the most insane things I have ever seen in any round of basketball. So, great question. We both end up leaning Chelsea there. Number two, who are your top five most aesthetically pleasing jump shot forms in the NBA currently? Xander says his top five would be Damian Lillard, Donovan Mitchell, Klay Thompson, Devin Booker, and Jaylen Brown. Steve, top five looking jumpers in the league.
I'll probably go Stephen Curry, Klay Thompson, Anthony Edwards, Kevin Durant, and Damian Lillard.
Okay. I like it. Like the quick, compact jumpers. I respect that. I think for me, like I am, and the people that know me personally, I am very much a fan of like, hey, give me elevation, give me a sway, give me a lean of some sort. It just kind of speaks ease to me. And so because of that, like there are like moderate to like below average shooters that have forms that I like. Like I am a big fan of Stephon Castle's jumper, even though it does not go in enough right now. Like I was a fan of Andre Iguodala's jumper, even though it didn't go in enough, because I just liked the sway and the lean of it. So like that, just if we're talking aesthetics, like those are the types of jumpers that I prefer. So like in the league right now, like Tim Hardaway Jr., quick with a sway. MPJ, a lot of elevation, also has the sway. Zach LaVine, a little bit more compact, but also has kind of the sway to it. Stephon Castle, as I mentioned. Devin Vassell, like, has the sway plus the super high release point on top of that. And so, like, I love his jumper, especially when he's taking those off the move, when he's coming off of those pin downs, off of those curls in San Antonio. So I love all of those. Honorable mentions for me of Isaiah Joe, because naturally. DeMar DeRozan, the shot profile always kind of gets me, but the actual jumper itself is a nice one. That is also the jumper base that I use on 2K. So thank you, DeMar, for that. Klay Thompson and Steph Curry are also on my honorable mentions list because duh. Kevin Durant's a fun one for me. And the wild card that I'm sure I'm going to get laughed at for you, Steve. I am an appreciator of the Jaren Jackson Jr. jumper. Lower release point, but I like the lean for him. So like when he's on one of the shot making mixers from D, like I just love the way it looks for him. So those are some of my favorite looking jumpers in the league. And the third question. Lastly, with the discourse flying around Dame, Steph, Clay, and Devin Booker already committing to the 3-point contest for next year, why do you think star players are more willing to perform poorly in a shooting contest than they are in a dunk contest? Is it needing to come up with creative dunking ideas instead of stationary shooting? Cheers from Australia. So thank you for the trio questions, Xander.
Yes, thank you for the questions. I think for me, I would just say it's probably easier to erase a bad 3-point shooting night in a contest than a bad dunk contest night. I mean, if you think about it, if I'm a good 3-point shooter, I'm going to shoot well from three. I can do that in the regular season. I can make shots in the playoffs. It's not going to take away my reputation as a shot maker. You may be more likely to remember what, for example, John Collins did in the dunk contest than the last John Collins dunk that he's had. You know, you made that. If you have a bad dunk contest moment, that's going to stick in a way that it won't for a 3-point contest. Now, there's a whole generation that doesn't remember Michael Jordan ever competed in a 3-point contest, but it happened. So, I mean, I just think if you are a shooter, it's more, like even we heard it live. Reggie and Jamal were like, oh, he just didn't have it tonight. Doesn't mean they can't shoot. Just means they didn't do well in that. There's a stationary element, you know, that's different than just pure shooting. Like you can get away with it more than a dunk contest. So that's my thought.
Okay. Shout out to John Collins, one of the most efficient post scorers in the league this year. So that's been a fun one. So I was looking up the K stats earlier. His name popped there. But to the question itself, like I do think to Steve's point, like the context is just different. I think the memory factor there is a little bit different. And like even with a 3-point contest, the best shooters in the league, you think you're knocking down 40% of your three. Like the best shooters inherently mean you are missing 60% of the time. It's like if you miss shots, like it just kind of baked in. With dunks, like there is just the overall bar that we've seen from past contests. You get to the MJ and Dominique stuff. You get Vince Carter in 2000. You get the LaVine, Aaron Gordon. You get the Derrick Jones. Like the bar is so much higher for the dunk contest. And just by what the nature of the event is, that if you do poorly, to Steve's point, like we will remember those. I guess on the flip side of that, like even if you don't win the contest, if you do a memorable enough dunk, like we will remember those as well. Like I think we are still collectively talking about what Aaron Gordon did in that contest and ultimately didn't get it done in his back and forth with Zach LaVine. But like, yeah, I think the bar is higher and thus the stakes are higher. And thus, if you don't perform well, we are going to remember what that looks like. Or if there's a dunk where it's like, hey, what exactly was this? That's going to be a little bit more memorable than like I will remember like Bobby Portis had what 15 in his first round. Like I'm probably not going to remember that next year when we talk about all-star preview stuff until I look that up again. You know what I mean? So I think it is just a little bit different on that front, but thank you, Xander, and cheers to Australia. Now, next one coming from Brandon, who says, hey guys, I have another thought regarding the whole face of the league narrative. I'm sure both of you would agree with me in that we simply should just appreciate all the talents that we have in the league today and what they bring to the table. Yes. However, I think being the face of the league is something that happens organically by winning consistently, hence Steph and LeBron. But with the new constraints on team building and inability to keep a team together, I think the increase in parity has affected the opportunity for one team or player to leave their mark and therefore become the face of the league. What are your thoughts? Like, I would say generally, like, I think I agree with that. Like, I haven't thought, that hasn't been top of mind for me as a reason. For me, it's generally just been like, I think it is just harder to win today. And I think because players are a lot more accessible, because the social environment is what it is, I feel like fan support, and I don't even think this is inherently a bad thing, I think fan support is just a little bit more spread out right now. But I think to the team building portion, and thus the winning portion, I do think that's why it's not as easy to get to, you know, like LeBron won 4 across different teams, but like LeBron has his own institution and he wins 4 or 5. Kobe wins 5. Duncan wins 5. MJ wins 6. Like, you don't have that kind of championship mystique to the same level, because it is difficult to kind of stack those kind of dynasties that raises that entire profile there. So, like, I think that's a good point to bring up, like something I want to chew on a little bit more. But I think that's a fair thing to bring up. Like, I think it's more difficult for that to happen in that way. I think becoming the face is still an organic ordeal, but like the parameters around doing that are a little bit different than they were like 10 years ago.
I mean, I think seven different champions in 7 years. I think it's hard for, with that kind of parity and with how accessible basketball is to a lot more people these days, to have one singular face that's going to dominate. I think it's just going to be a rotating wheel, especially with the way that the players are discussed and built up and broken down, and player movement and team movement. I don't know if you're going to get to one singular dominant force that is just the face of the league. I think you're going to have multiple, which I don't think is a bad thing. I think there's a larger path for more players to be seen and heard these days. So you can have your Anthony Edwards, you can have your Shea, you can have your Cade Cunningham, you can have Wimby. So I think there's like a more of an orbit they can all exist in, but I don't know if we're going to have that singular force, because I don't think anybody can agree on anything when it comes to that. So
yeah,
that's where I'm at with it.
Yeah, I think quickly today, and before we get to the next question, like, it was kind of funny at All-Star, as Wimby's being asked about being the face of the league, and he's like, I understand where you're going, like, I'm just trying to be the best version of myself, was essentially his answer. And like, that kind of thing comes if I perform the way I'm supposed to and my team performs the way it's supposed to. And like, I think we're all well aware of like Anthony Edwards' stance on the bit. Like, hey, y'all got Wimby, I'm good. I don't need this. While also still just being one of the most charismatic players and one of the best players in the league anyway. So people naturally gravitate to him regardless of what he's saying on that front. So I guess there is like also an element of, do you want this? How much are the players going to embrace that title? But I like that question, though. That was a good one. That was a good one. Next one going to come from Jen Jen. Day One Dunker says, hello, Steve and Nikias. Hope you're both feeling good, feeling great. First of all, thank you both for all you do to make basketball a more inclusive place. Now for my question. While I know his case gets more difficult now that he's on the Wolves and next to Naz Reid, is Ayo Dosunmu a dark horse candidate for Sixth Man of the Year?
He's going to have to go on a run real quick. He's going to have to go on a real quick run, and Minnesota's going to have to win some games for him to get that. I wouldn't be opposed to it. I think he can have a major impact for Minnesota, but it's going to be tough with Naz Reid existing and a lot of other players on different teams kind of having a head start in some of the impact categories as far as helping their teams win. But I can see it. I would definitely say it out loud if he gets hot. How about you, Nikias?
Okay, I like it. Like, I think, you know, my general thoughts, like, hey, you kind of need to be the best reserve on your team. And so, like, I think you can make an argument that between Ayo and Naz Reid, he is having the better reserve season. Like, I do kind of wonder how the waters get muddied with now them being on the same team. And so Naz has done more as a reserve than Ayo has with Minnesota. Like, I'm just going to have to, like, parse through that one mentally. But I think just in a vacuum, Ayo has been good enough to be in that discussion. And if you now get the impact boost for Ayo going to a win-now situation in Minnesota, those moments are going to be pretty loud for him. And so I think in the minds of voters, especially depending on like how you feel about the Naz Reid defense in particular, and like he did get off to a slow start this year before ramping up and being the Naz Reid that we are more accustomed to. Like, I think there's going to be a pathway for Ayo Dosunmu. Like, I will probably have like some principal arguments by the time we talk about this at the end of the season. But I think Ayo himself has been very good. Just looking at his reserve stats, 38 games, 14.6 points per game on 64 true shooting, shooting 43% from three in his games off the bench this year. But 15-3-3 is pretty darn good stuff when you also factor in what he can do defensively. and just again narrowing down what the transition impact is, what the off-ball impact is, what his presence means for like Anthony Edwards in Minnesota and things like that. If he's part of closing lineups, that's going to help him. So I could probably get two dark horse candidate, top three or top four candidate. Like that might get a little dicier. We have some really good cases. Like Steve and I are fresh off of the Spurs Suns broadcast for League Pass. Check that out if you haven't already. Like Keldon Johnson, I think is going to factor pretty heavily into the conversation, just as a quick example. But I think it's fair to keep an eye on Aya. We can now move to the next one. This one coming from Money, who says, "Heidi Ho Dunkaroos, longtime listener, first time emailer." In parentheses, I've always wanted to say that. "As someone who's unfortunately a Kings fan, this recent injury news for Domantas Sabonis, Zach LaVine, and Dylan Cartwell means we're going to be playing the young guys more. What are some lineups you guys are excited to see the Kings bring out? How do you guys see the reintroduction of Keegan Murray with these young cats work out? Is there anything I should look forward to for the rest of the season? Keep up the amazing work." Hey, listen, I don't mind going first on this one. I think the answer is kind of in the question for me. The fact that the Kings are now, quote unquote, forced to play more of this young talent. We get to see Neat Clifford with the ball in his hands a little bit more. We ideally get to see a little bit more of Devin Carter, at the very least. Let's see what Maxine Raynaud can continue to do. Like, I think he's been, I said it on the pod with a week or so ago. Like, I'm kind of surprised that Maxine Raynaud didn't end up being in the Rising Stars competition, especially with some of the injury replacements that we had. But, like, he has been one of the better rookies in the league over the last, what, 2-3 months, if you want to extend it out. So, getting more Maxine Raynaud, do we let him take some threes? Are we going to give him more ball handling, just in general, more playmaking responsibilities in addition to just some of the rim roller stuff? Like, I'm excited to see them lean more into that. And with Keegan Murray being reintroduced to this lineup alongside these young guys, like, okay, that's a similar note that I've hit with Keegan Murray. What are these on-ball reps going to look like, big dog? Are we letting you run initiate handoffs? Are we letting you run pick and roll more? Do you get to, just in general, initiate more offense to take some of this pressure off of a Neat Clifford or any other young guards there? So, like, I think the fun for you is seeing these guys kind of stretch their limits in games that ultimately aren't going to matter. If you give Neat Clifford 35 pick and rolls in a game and the Kings win, like, again, you're keeping an eye on lottery odds naturally, but it's just like, okay, we won because of the young guy that we just drafted. Like, I can feel good about that. Maxine Raynaud puts up 20-17. Yeah, we wanted to keep an eye on our lottery odds, but we won because of the guy that we just drafted. Like, that's going to be the fun. In terms of lineups that I'm going to want to see, give me Plowden, give me Carter, give me Clifford, give me Murray, give me Raynaud. Like, any amount of that five-man grouping is going to be the fun for me. A lot of defense, a lot of energy, some fun shot creation there. Enough shooting around Raynaud if you want to unlock some of the pick-and-roll stuff. Like, that's probably where I would want to go. Give me the youth is where I'm at. What say you, good sir?
I mean, you just need Devin Carter, Neat Clifford, Keegan Murray, Maxime Raynaud. Any combination of those four plus one would be fine. Mm. So that should be what you want to see. Let's see what these guys have down the stretch of the season.
All righty. We got two more mailbag submissions, three total questions. This one's going to come from Kieran. Excuse me if I mispronounced that. You have permission to yell at me if I got that wrong. But number one, with so many players in new places post-trade deadline, what is the balance for coaches having the new players fit in with the scheme or identity that's already there versus slightly tweaking your scheme / what you do to get the most out of the incoming player?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on the type of player. And usually you're trying to find someone who's either going to elevate what you do or bring like something slightly better that enhances what you do, if that makes sense. So it's not like you're going to automatically change everything you do for this player. Now, you may add more things for them. But if you're looking at like a James Harden in Cleveland, yeah, we may just be able to do a couple more pick and roll things, take some plays that he's used before. But that's not going to change necessarily our fit offensively as our spacing and everything. We just have someone who can elevate our pick and roll play. So I think it's just depending on how good your team is, how strong your identity is, and what you do the most. So I don't think you're going to change your identity all of a sudden because you have a different type of player. You know, if they bring a different element, that may help. But I think it's more in integrating them into what you do and getting the most out of them within that, if that makes sense. I don't think you're going to tweak all of your scheme, especially this late in the season, to specifically, you know, gravitate towards that player unless you were really took a swing for the fences, in my opinion. But more times than not, you know, coaches are, it's refreshing to have something that's a little bit different. So you can add some different things in defensively or offensively, depending what type of player you got. But it's hard to really just go, yep, we're going to do all of this for this player. It's pretty tough.
Okay. I think you hit the major notes there, so I won't hang there too long, Steve. Like, I think you don't really get into the scheme tweaking, et cetera, unless this is someone that's like shifting your hierarchy in some kind of way. Or I guess like more of a defensive thing. We're adding a center that allows us to execute more coverages, so that naturally now we just open up the playbook a little bit more. But to your point, like, it's more so like, can you enhance what we already do? Like, even James Harden coming into Cleveland, like, they're not becoming a pick and roll team. They are already running plenty. You have Donovan Mitchell, you had Darius Garland when healthy. It's now you are just substituting Darius Garland for James Harden. And so like, the volume may shift there because of how good Harden is and how durable he is, but the actual concepts themselves haven't changed that much. So I think Steve nailed that one. As for the second question, I know a little bit about Steve's basketball background with his dad being a D1 player and being a coach in the league. For Nikias, I was wondering about your background with ball and where you were able to acquire so much knowledge on the game. It is very true. I do not have the credentials of my esteemed co-host here in Steve. So for me, I think, don't make the face. That's very much a compliment. okay, you got it. But no, in all seriousness, like for me, and I think I've told this story before, like I very much grew in love with basketball, but like football was initially my favorite sport. Played that more so growing up. It was like football and NASCAR for me, as my granddad was and still is a pretty big NASCAR fan. Shout out Jeff Gordon, et cetera. So love for basketball mostly started with one of my best friend, Glenn Thompson, getting to play hoops with him, rec league stuff, went to school together. And so a lot of my love was fostered there. A lot of love fostered with like the random national basketball games I was able to catch on TV. a whole lot of video game stuff, as I was very much a quiet / introverted kid. So NBA Live was a big part of my life growing up. And so just kind of losing myself in the dynasty mode there. And so that's where a lot of the team building interest came for me. And just in general, like having to kind of analyze within that lens, I think that kind of helped unlock how I wanted to approach basketball. Like, okay, why exactly is this team good? How can we make this team good? Why are these players good? That kind of thing. I think that's where some of the early love came from. And then from there, like, again, playing a little rec, naturally just hooping a bunch, pick up and stuff like that, getting to watch more, getting to learn more. This is where it sparked the initial, like, helping run NBA Talk, a Facebook page. So, like, breaking down free agency acquisitions and, like, getting into the analysis on that front. So that part kind of leaned in. As far as learning, a bunch of reading and then eventually a whole bunch of podcast stuff. And so a lot of Zach Lowe, a lot of Chris Herring, eventually coming across Steve, Caitlin Cooper. And so just kind of finding anyone that was getting into any kind of scheme thing. It's like kind of downloading that into the memory bank. And so naturally once the pods kind of accompanied that, it's like, okay, well, let me listen to these and get more of like a broader perspective. And so that combined with watching and covering a bunch of Miami Heat basketball in general, I was able to kind of go from Heat analysis to NBA analysis, and thus with the basketball concepts that I learned from so many of these other great minds, that transitions into W analysis. And like, I've just kind of been able to build the knowledge bank from there. So like, naturally, as I get more into media and getting credentialed, now I can actually ask players questions. I can ask coaches questions that also adds to the knowledge bank. So I started with rec stuff plus video games, honestly. And it's kind of snowballed from there over the last, 20 plus years of my life. And that's how we got there. There we go. I love the Steve. I love the face here from Steve. Last question is going to come from Jeremy, who says, while I understand you two can find the positives in each NBA team, I need you both to hit the respectfully messy button and identify which team seems the most rudderless in the NBA.
It's the Kings.
It's the Kings for you?
Yep.
That's fair. Like, it's probably also Sacramento for me, because like, I just don't get how you end up with this much salary on your books and you ultimately didn't get rid of any of the big salary guys, et cetera. You don't have like a true blue chipper, even though they do have young guys that I like. That's just part of weird. I do wonder, because it's Jeremy specifically, like how much of this question was a lead into, hey, can you talk about like what the Pelicans got going on right now and what they're trying to do? Because as much as I've enjoyed Derek Queen, like that trade did still just happen. But it's probably the Kings until further notice. Like, they have to bend that. I was very tempted to turn this into yet another Heat rant, but I've already done that, and I don't think that would be fair to them if we're talking league-wide stuff. I am still frustrated with their overall direction. We will see what the next 6 or 8 months looks like for the Miami Heat. But with that, We are going to take a break, and when we return, we will preview the unrivaled action of the weekend. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. We have more unrivaled action coming your way. We are approaching pretty quickly, Steve, the end of the regular season, the playoffs starting next weekend on that front. And if we're talking about another announcement, MVP voting ends on Monday. And so I think we're going to get into some awards thoughts on Tuesday. Just wanted to make you aware that it's almost about that time to get into some MVP conversation. But the playoffs are rapidly approaching. We have some fun matchups heading into the weekend that also have some legitimate playoff stakes. One that doesn't at the moment right now, or at least not on the major sense. The first game of Friday night, we have the Phantom taking on the Laces. The top two teams in league standings wise, the Phantom 8-3, the Laces are 9-2. Both teams have already clinched their playoff spots, but as they are the best two teams in the league, like I am one just on a general note, kind of curious to see, like, does the minute distribution change at all between these two, since they've already clinched, they have no real risk of falling out of, well, I won't say that. I guess the Mist could technically pass like one of those two to get into two. But I do wonder, do they do anything differently rotation-wise since we're this close to the playoffs, or if this is going to be like more of a pride, like we want to prove we're the best team in the league. That should be a fun one. Those defenses are elite. The guard players strong.
I would imagine it's going to be a battle for pride between these two competitive teams. If you're looking at Brittany Sykes, Melissa Thomas, Jack Young on one side, and you have Kelsey Plum and Aaliyah Boston trying to figure it out on the other side, especially with Kiki, I would imagine this would be a competitive game. So even though they both have clinched playoff spots, I would imagine the Phantom would like to be first. I would imagine the Laces would like to remind the Phantom that we beat you last time and we're the best team in the league. So I would imagine that to not just be a walk in the park. Especially with both the teams kind of having the runs they've had of late. So I'm looking forward to that one. I think that one gets real competitive real quick.
I like it. That should be a fun one. And then in the nightcap, Steve, we have Hive BC taking on Rose BC. The Rose still trying to find some rhythm, 5-6 right now. The Hive just outside the playoff picture, I think a game behind the Vinyl right now. But that is the Angel Reese return game, Steve. What are you going to be looking for in this one with Angel in particular?
Return of Angel and Chelsea. That's always fun to see them play together. And then how does Angel's defense impact? What do the drives look like? I think we saw a lot of growth from Angel Reese last year in Unrivaled, especially with, you know, I'm going to catch the ball where I want to. I'm going to defend in space. I'm going to find ways to attack in different areas. So what kind of growth will we see there? It'll be interesting to see what the Hive can do. I mean, the Hive's formula has been, we can just kind of bother you for three quarters. That fourth quarter, are you ready for, you know, Kelsey Mitchell, you're ready for Sony Citron. They have the size to kind of just bother you over the course of a game and make it tough in the fourth. So can they kind of hit that formula? Because while time is running out, you get a win, you're only a game behind the Rose. And who knows what happens in the final over the weekend. So this is kind of like your last gasp if you're the Hive and the Lunar Isles this weekend. You kind of make one last push, see if you can get yourself in a different scenario going down the stretch. But for me, it's about the Rose. Does that return elevate them? Can they get right? Can they push themselves back into a strong position come playoff time?
Yeah, and I think as we saw last year, like, hey, you can kind of roam around the middle of the standings as long as you're playing your best basketball heading into the postseason. They just made the championship run. Also, Steve, it's very excited to say this. We get the Azaray Stevens revenge game. We got some revenge games happening this weekend, so that should be fun. So we'll see what that looks like. If you talk about the overall size deal. And as I have kind of poked at, like, hey, what exactly is this Rose defense? When it hums, and then they can lean on the shot, make it on the other end, they're very tough. When the defense slips at all, it can get kind of dicey. So in this matchup, you mentioned Kelsey Mitchell and Sonya Citron. They got to be able to bring it. Switches got to be tight. And to that end, like, how does Angel impact that? I think I'm right there with you. Should be a fun one. Then we head into Saturday. The Vinyl at 4-7 right now. They're holding on to that sixth seed, but a game ahead of the Hive and the Lunar Isles right now. Taking on the Breeze, still trying to settle in a little bit as they implement some new pieces right now. Should be a fun one. And then the nightcap there, Lunar Isles taking on the Mist. They clinched their playoff spot with the Hive loss on Tuesday, so they are also in on that front. Anything in particular stand out about those two matchups, Steve?
The Breeze definitely have lost two in a row and need to kind of figure this thing out, because as we've seen them be fun for most of the season, teams starting to get a little bit of a rhythm against, okay, we know where your bigs are going to be at. We can score on you. We're going to make sure your lineups are a little bit unbalanced. And, you know, Paige has been great, but who else is scoring for you? We're going to take the drives away. So they need to get some momentum going into the playoffs and to make sure they stay in that race, because, I mean, Vinyl knocking on the door, Hive knocking on the door. Do the Lunar Owls have one more swing? With the type of competitors they have, with the type of talent they have, do they have one more swing at the bat? You're going to have to put them away. Mm-hmm. From the mist, I just need the Lunar Owls to be done. Like, dude, we just have to get you out of here, unfortunately. Because do you really want to deal with Marina and Skyler and Lee Edwards in a setting? Like, that's not necessarily what you want to have to deal with. So keep them down while you can is probably be my advice.
Yeah, that is a lot of bucket getting on the Lunar Isle side. And something that you brought up, Steve, is that, hey, this Miss team is very talented. There's a level of lineup versatility they can get into. If they're not knocking down jumpers, the offense can get a little hazy. So if Lunar Isles are able to get enough stops, they have the bucket getters on the other end. So that should be a fascinating matchup. And with Divinal and the Breeze need to find themselves. Divinal, as I've talked about on here before, like, hey, what exactly is the offensive consistency here? And so I just kind of wonder, is this a get right game for the Breeze defensively, to your point, Steve, or are the Vinyl able to kind of tap into some of the cracks of the Breeze defense that we've seen as of late? Are they able to find some stuff and give themselves a little bit more breather room? As again, they are a game ahead of the Hive and the Lunar Isles. Now you get into like tiebreaker stuff with the head to heads and things like that. But hey, man, they kind of need to win this one, because if they do not, it gets kind of hazy. Then your Sunday games, you have Phantom taking on the Hive. You have Laces taking on the Rose. And then on Monday, you have the Lunar Owls taking on the Vinyl. Again, very much playoff implications there. And you have the Mist taking on the Breeze. Among those four, which one stands out to you, Steve? What are you excited about?
I mean, they all stand out to me in different ways. I mean, we talked about it's interesting the Hive and the Rose play each other. Then they have to face the top of the league. So whoever wins, I mean, it's going to be tough to get two out of this weekend, but you need to try your best. I think Lunar Owls Vinyl gets real interesting if the Lunar Owls are able to pull off a win early in the weekend. And I think Miss Breeze can also get real interesting. I think it's those two teams need to find momentum, so I'd like to see what they look like after their first games, but I think there's a lot of shuffling that could happen, so I'm keeping an eye on Lunar Isles and Vinyl depending on the results. And also, can the Rose kind of establish themselves with Angel Reese and say, hey, we get a win and then we beat the Laces, now look at us, we're back in a position that, you know, people thought had us early in the season. So they all kind of stand out for different reasons. What about you, buddy?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, I think for me, like, it's kind of peeping. This is a real opportunity for the Lunar Isles. Again, we talked about the offense, the bucket getting from Marina and Skyler and Aaliyah Edwards. Like, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that they beat the Mist, especially if it's a game in which the offense is a little bit hazy for them. And if you beat the Vinyl, like, this is where you get right into, wait, are the Vinyl the 7 seed as we get to recording the pod on Tuesday? Like, that's not going to be a position they want to be in heading into the literal final stretch of games and then the playoffs starting shortly after. So I'm just kind of on alert for the Lunar Owls in particular and the Vinyl in particular. So like, that matchup is probably top of mind for me in terms of entertainment factor, like Laces Rose. You're looking at the best team in the league right now. Or I guess we'll see what the record is after their matchup with the Phantom. But that squad, you get Chelsea and Jackie again. So we see if there's any like one-on-one revenge happening in that matchup in particular. But again, it's another game with Angel Reese getting reacclimated with this group rather. And so that is where I would have it. But entertaining stretch of games coming up. I'm excited to see what happens on this front. And again, as mentioned at the top, MVP voting ends 5 p.m. Eastern on Monday. And so like, I don't think that's going to be announced Tuesday. It's going to be announced, I would imagine, end of the regular season. But we at least get to talk about some award stuff on the next pod. So stay tuned for that one. And with that, thank you
Hold on. Before you get there, I have one free throw for you. Okay. So it's about the Philadelphia 76ers. Obviously, okay, they're trying to make sure Joel Embiid is healthy. But when he's out of the lineup and they're kind of leaning on BJ Edgecombe and they're scoring, are they Tyrese Maxing?
Wow. And so like, this is layered because I know that you've seen tweets about like possession maxing and 3-point rate maxing and stuff. And I know you don't like that.
It's too late. I already said it. Get us out of here.
This is shameful from Steve. You know what? Thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week. You are unbelievable.